Signal is a podcast by the Bucks County Beacon. I'm your host and the Beacon's editor-in-chief, Cyril McGlaco. Twice a month, we'll use this space to shine a light on the right-wing extremist currents streaming through Bucks County and beyond. We'll talk to guests who will help listeners navigate these perilous political waters by providing insight, analysis, and organizing solutions so that we can steer the community toward calmer, saner, progressive routes. On this special episode of The Signal, we welcome Connor O'Hanlon onto the show. Connor is chair of the Democratic Party in Doylestown and has spent his young adulthood serving his community on multiple nonprofit and governmental boards. Connor's passion for progressive change led him to run for office at the age of 23, and shortly thereafter he became chairman of the local party. In his role as director of candidate development for the Bucks County Democratic Committee, he has coached and aided dozens of candidates to successfully run for office. His interest and knowledge of politics are amplified by his education from the Fellows Institute of Government at the University of Pennsylvania. Today we talk about Connor's new book, Building a Greater Society, A Guide to Political Revolution for Millennials and Generation Z, which you can pre-order now. Hi, Connor. Welcome to The Signal.
Thanks for having me, Cyril. I appreciate it.
Before we get into your new book that's coming out this fall, I was hoping that you'd be able to tell us a little bit about how and why you first became involved in politics and specifically progressive politics.
Definitely. It's a great question. Get asked that a lot. So a lot of people assume like, oh, my parents were in politics or, you know, a family member or somebody, but it's not the case. I've always just had like a little bit of a fascination with history, you know, going through the Central Bucks School District, had some good teachers that kind of ingrained that in me, but never really politics. It was never politics. I had a fascination with like certain leaders and whatnot, but in 2016, that was the first election that I could vote in. So obviously a pretty consequential election. I started following all the primaries on both the Democratic and the Republican side. And I honestly didn't really know like which I identified with, you know, back in 2015 as an 18-year-old. I was like, you know, I could kind of see this and that. And, you know, you didn't have like the world application yet. But the Bernie Sanders campaign really is what like caught my eye. Him speaking to issues of inequality, especially, really brought that forward. And I know like Bernie gets like a, and this is already a tangent, but Bernie gets like a certain rap as to like who follows him. But especially over the last couple of years, you've seen like an intersectional left kind of building that addresses class issues. And that's really what got me involved. And then when I graduated from Penn State in 2018, I wanted to get more involved on the local level. So when I came back to Doylestown, I went to vote in the May primary. And I remember meeting and I write about it in the book, this guy named Stan, and Stan doesn't live in Doylestown anymore. He moved out to Seattle, but he introduced me and talked to me about, you know, this is what we do on the local level. This is Doylestown Democrats. And from there, I just joined the group and the rest is history, I'd say.
Great. And Stan, was he like, he was a member of the party or
yes.
An officer of the party?
So Stan at the time was a committee person. So I'm the chair now. So in Doylestown Township and Doylestown Borough, there's 28 committee people.
Cool. So like we said, your first book's coming out in the fall. It's Building a Greater Society, A Guide to Political Revolution for Millennials and Generation Z. Why this book and why now?
So this book I've been working on since the day after I lost my first election. And it's evolved quite a bit from then. Right now, obviously, it's consequential with the 2024 election coming, arguably the most consequential election so far, at least in the modern era, how we are going to steer the future of the country. The reason why now is millennials and Generation Z, or as I call them in throughout the book, Zoomers, are the largest voting bloc. Single generation or double generation at this point. So millennials as a single generation are the largest part of the voting population. So millennials, I'm the youngest of the millennials. That's why I wrote it for both millennials and Generation Z, because I kind of hover. But that's really why. The book originally was kind of like a counterpoint to a lot of the perceptions of politics today from the older generation. So that's why I start off with the comparison of the generations and saying like our viewpoints, the stereotypes about us, especially millennials, like millennials get labeled as all these different things. So millennials are, and Generation Z, I should say, but millennials specifically are hungry for like taking the reins of power, getting involved, and really leading our government into the future. Whereas older generations are kind of dragging their heels. And I'd say specifically in the Democratic Party so far, we can argue that, you know, not just you and me, but anybody. But I see it more as a problem on the Democratic side. And being a Democrat and a progressive, it's important to me that we welcome a new generation of leadership. So that's why it's important now.
Well, can you define millennials and Generation Z or Zoomers for the audience?
Yeah. So Generation Z starts in 1997, and I believe ends in 2005. And then it goes into Generation Alpha. I could be wrong on the end of Generation Z, but I am 1996, so I'm the youngest millennial. And I believe the earliest millennial is 1982. So that's your birth year.
And then are there any kind of, you know, common threads or traits in the politics that you've seen or identified in these two youthful generations?
Yeah, I think they're different. And I think that they've begun to diverge. And again, because I walk the line of both of them, it's an interesting dynamic. But millennials have gone through multiple enormous recessions, like to the point where like these shouldn't happen within like what, like your lifetime more than once. Yeah. So you have like the COVID recession and the Great Recession that dramatically impact their employment opportunities and their growth as a generation with wealth. Their investment in their family, so being able to start a family, is really hard, or it has been hard for millennials. So it's like you see a drop in the birth rate, one, but also a drop in in the increase in the age of the average person having kids and starting families. You have the increase in housing. Like these are issues that just are specifically hitting millennials harder than other generations, way harder than our boomer parents, or my parents are on the edge with the Generation X, but we're the equivalent, I suppose. But it hits those generations very differently. Millennials are much more class aware. I think that Generation Z is also has that class awareness. The difference has started to become, I've seen, is that where both are kind of feeling an intersectional growth, like we're all focusing on social justice. Generation Z seems a little bit more like Gen X, where they're like skeptical, a little bit more cynical, I'd say, than millennials. I've been called, you know, which is funny because I'm not like this in my regular life, but like, you know, way too optimistic when it comes to some of the policies and the proposals that I believe in. And that comes from both ends. It's from younger people and from older people, from different critiques, definitely. The older folks, it's an ideological. The younger, it's a pragmatic critique. So it's just definitely an interesting dynamic. So Gen Z, they're activists. They're just different from the millennials. But I would say that they're probably equally as progressive in many ways, but cynical.
I mean, do you think that, you know, because of these economic hardships that they've been living through, this has impacted their, you know, thinking and beliefs about how the economy should be run? Do you feel like that they believe that the government should have a more robust role in the economy, or has this kind of like pushed them to thinking or adapting a more kind of like laissez-faire, libertarian, like free market fundamentalism that you see kind of pushed on the right?
I think it depends. So I think like you've seen an extremism develop on the right. So there is like that extremism in the populist right. And there's some overlap with populism on the right and like progressivism on the left and just class awareness. I would definitely say that there's an overall change in perception of capitalism from millennials and Generation Z. So for me, I identify as a social democrat. I believe in a mixed economy. I think all of us actually believe in mixed economies, but when you talk about it, people want to argue about the minutia. We all draw a line somewhere as to like what our line is, what the tax rate we want is, or how much government influence we want. But I think for an example, there's the 4-day work week thing that comes up, and Bernie put up a proposal officially this past couple of weeks, but it's been around for a little while. I read a book called Stolen Focus, and Johan Hari, I think, is the author. And it talks about like the impact and the increased productivity over the last like 50 years. And just to say, like, if we actually cut from a 40-hour work week to a 32-hour work week, there's no loss in efficiency. The productivity is high. The profitability of companies is high. So someone like me, a millennial or even now Gen Z, we ask like, why is it 40 hours a week? And people want to say, oh, well, it's you guys are lazy. You guys are this or that. It's like, well, we don't have to make our lives revolve around work anymore. We can be more efficient and engage in other parts of our lives, live happier lives, like the Scandinavian countries. You see, like, they're consistently in the top five happiest countries in the world. We have the success and the productivity and all these things that we can be like that. We just have to choose to. So it's like, it's all about perception, in my opinion.
And I believe we just actually fell out of the top 20 happiest countries just this year. And with the 4-day work week as well, that's actually something PA House Dems have kind of floated as a bill and a proposal. So you write in your book that it's a wake-up call to apathy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, who's apathy?
Again, I think that specifically Generation Z is so, sometimes, and I have to be careful how I want to say this, but sometimes like rage and anger is good and it can be channeled into something. And like, I know somebody told me a couple of years ago when I wanted to run for state rep that, oh, like I see you talk about these things and you seem angry. It's like, well, yeah, you should be angry that there's homeless people that they don't have a roof over their head. There's hungry people that don't have food. You know, there's people that don't have healthcare and they die because they get cancer and they just can't see a doctor. You should be angry. But when we don't plug that into something pragmatic to problem solve is when it starts to get like, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
And people become apathetic to say like, well, the system is so big, so we can't do anything about it. Well, I mean, if we just let that be and we never take action, it's just only going to get worse. I mean, people love to talk about 1984, Brave New World, all these different things. Like, I know these are fictional novels and all that stuff, but like the longer you just let things be, the worse they're going to get. So if you don't take action now, you know, you can't be angry 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, at least justifiably so. I'm not saying it's just for my younger folks, like younger than me. Mm-hmm. There's definitely people that just have been turned off by the political system itself. They just think, you know, the two parties are the same. They're not. But that doesn't mean that there's no flaws in the Democratic Party. It means that you should get involved with the party that you want to, that are more closely aligned to, and steer the ship. I talk about throughout the book, you know, parties are just vehicles. You know, I don't agree with the Democratic Party on everything, but I think it's the best vehicle to push forth a progressive ideology and get as much pragmatic policy to help better people's lives as we possibly can. So you have to get involved in primaries, activism, organizing. If like actually being in the party is not good enough, then like at least vote in primaries. Like there's certain things that are like baseline. And then there's higher level stuff.
Sure. I mean, at least locally, I'm kind of like hopeful that people are recognizing like how much impact a local election can have. Like, mm-hmm. for example, on the school board level, you know, where you're at in Central Bucks School District, you know, we can see, you know, for better and for worse, what local elections can do. For worse, we've seen, you know, what the, you know, prior to November, what the previous 2 years of kind of like a right-wing Moms for Liberty MAGA school board majority and the type of damage that they can do. And then now, you know, with a lot of community organizing on the grassroots level from, you know, local Democrats, local parents, students as well, even, you know, we've seen how flipping a school board can kind of protect the values that Democrats cherish and protect, you know, something as vital to a democracy as public education. You mentioned earlier you had this, you know, when you were at Central Bucks as a student, you developed a fascination with history, you know, thanks to some of the excellent teachers that teach there. And history actually plays a big role in your book.
Mm-hmm.
the book surveys a lot of American history, you know, which would include, you know, the New Deal, the World Wars, Cold War, the rise of neoliberalism in the 70s, you know, how the Democratic Party kind of like took a bit of a right turn towards a more centrist kind of corporatist kind of vision, you know, that Bill Clinton and his cohorts championed at the time. Why did you decide to kind of like include this historical survey in your book, in a book that is talking about political revolution and movement building for millennials and Generation Z today?
I think it simply boils down to history repeats itself. I genuinely believe that we could enter a second progressive era coming out of this, you know, the 2020s, like we did in the 1920s leading into the New Deal. Functionally, I think a lot of people didn't get the benefit of having like a great teacher like I had and or teachers that I had. And of course, like this is written from the historical perspective of a layman. So like I'm giving you like what happened, but like with also my opinion kind of attached to it. So it's like we're going through these eras and I'm like, well, you know, this kind of seems like this issue that's happening today. I go through the 1960s and we talk about political unrest and through the civil rights era. And then I go, well, it's pretty similar to what happened in 2020, 2021, to the George Floyd, you know, protests and whatnot. And out of the 1960s gets the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. I ask now sometimes like, well, what did we get now? And we have to kind of like look at those perspectives and say like, well, what's the difference? Was it just because they had a pragmatic leader at the top? Was it Martin Luther King Jr.? Was it his assassination? I mean, these are questions. They're not necessarily like things that I answer, but there's certain opinions throughout that I say like, it's important to know X, Y, and Z about the New Deal, the Great Society, to understand why Ronald Reagan was so bad, in my opinion, or why George W. Bush was so bad, in my opinion, and how that leads the Democratic Party, unfortunately, to, I think, move in the wrong direction, which I do think in the last couple of years, we've moved in some cases in a better path. And I think that's from the 2016 forward, but you know, that's another topic.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, President Biden has actually been probably, you know, with the policies that have passed under his administration is probably one of the most progressive, is more progressive than the Obama administration.
Yeah. Yeah. He's been the most progressive arguably. And again, like I'll take, there's an asterisk with this because there's issues of like, you can say like with Israel and Palestine, right? Like no matter what side you're on it, like there's people that have an issue with him on that. But like a lot of the policies have been the most progressive, at least since LBJ. Some people might argue since FDR.
Yeah. And you know, with foreign policy, I mean, this is just an aside. I mean, I never really thought that much of a difference between how Democrats and Republicans, I think, exert their power on the world. I think Democrats just maybe put a bit of a more human face on it, but that could be a whole other episode talking about foreign policy.
Well, I mean, to be like, you know, to build off of it though, like, you know, part of the book on the more recent, like the 2000s to now is talking about endless wars. Joe Biden did get us out of Afghanistan, even if it was like botched, even if it was partly like Donald Trump's plan, which again, like people don't, whether it's good or bad, right? Like people blame Biden for how it went, even though it was Trump's like administration's plan. Like, well, he executed it. We got out of it. We ended a war that we shouldn't have been in, and we wasted $2 trillion on at least. So, and countless civilian lives. So it's like, we stopped a war and Joe Biden did that. So like, there's a positive and there's the negative on the foreign policy side. We can always go back and forth, I'm sure, you know, as I do throughout the book, right? Like there's different allusions to, like people don't know about like the Chilean government that was overthrown in the 1970s. They just don't know or have heard of like the CIA infiltrating into these countries and trying to overthrow their government. It's like, sometimes it's just worth understanding and knowing the context of which we came from.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good book by Stephen Kinzer called Overthrow, which kind of gives a survey of, you know, U.S. overthrowing, you know, other democracies and other countries. Which,
yeah, there's the same thing. It's called How Democracies Die. It's the same kind of concept.
Okay, so another kind of like issue with the book or topic with the book is it's the, you know, the conflict, you know, between generations, right? So is there anything that you think differentiates youth politics and activism today from from that of the past? Because like you mentioned earlier, like, you know, even with the 60s and, you know, with the civil rights movement, which was very youth led, you know, we've always kind of had this like conflict between like the youth and their parents and, you know, grandparents' generations.
This is not a gotcha question in response to you, but do you know how old Joe Biden was when he was elected to the Senate?
I'll guess 35.
He was 29.
Okay.
So he was a year older than I am. So Joe Biden, so not even old enough to take the office yet, because you have to be 30. So not to say that there's no difference in like, or that there is a gigantic difference in the conflict between generations, because I think that's a constant throughout history, is like, you know, young people are always like, we want big, bold changes and all that stuff.
Sure.
But in the past, the older generations didn't hold on to power into their 80s. And again, like, Joe Biden has my vote in the fall, right? Like, there's no argument about it. But it's like, there's something to be said about like having two guys that are basically 80 being our presidential candidates. And if you look at the Congress, like, there's one person that's my age there. How do I feel represented by our government? I don't. Maxwell Frost is the only person that's my age, and he's a year younger than me, right? So it's hard to be like accepting that, oh, it's just a historical thing. Like, young people always disagree with their elders, but it's like, well, they had a shot to actually get the reins of power, especially the boomer generation. They actually had the chance to run the country. Millennials, like, people want to act like millennials are like little babies still. I'm 28 and I'm the youngest millennial. So like, millennials are in their 40s. So it's like, we've never had a millennial president. We barely have any millennial senators, let alone Generation Z. That's a whole nother, like, they're not old enough yet, but that's a difference. And that's not to say like, oh, well, Joe Biden's maybe the exception. He's not. Like, he was the exception at that age, but in a historical parallel, the reins of power have not been passed on to the largest demographic of a voter block yet, the millennials. So like, if you just look at the Congress, and it's not to say like, oh, old people can't do it. I just said how Bernie was like my inspiration. It's just that we need a little bit more diversity in age, I think, or a lot more diversity in age in our representatives. And that happens on the state house as well. I mean, like, state house, state senate, local government, everybody wants like, oh, well, we can't have a young person running for local government because they X, Y, and Z. Or like, when I ran for office, people said like, well, you don't own a house. Well, how does that like, what is this, the Reconstruction era or the civil rights or the Civil War era? Like, because I don't own property, that I can't be a state representative. So like, that's the type of thing that's like, it erodes and it creates the apathy, it creates the distrust towards the party. And that's where we fail. And people keep asking me, why can't we get young people to come out? Why can't we get them involved? You have to give them the chance to be leaders, to be engaged, and make them feel like they're actually doing something beneficial, not just for the party, but for themselves and their futures.
You know, we've been talking about like the importance of getting youth in political office, but there's also a movement component to how history changes, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we look at the history that you've written about and that we've been talking about, you know, if you see like the Civil Rights Act, or like getting out of like Vietnam, or women's rights, like, this was like social movement organizing, creating a lot of noise on the streets, right? Kind of forcing the politicians, those in political office, to do what's right. It's not because they were enlightened and then they said, oh, we're going to finally like make these changes. It was like, no, people were holding their feet to the fire. And that's as a result of kind of like grassroots movement organizing. So like, you know, we've talked about like, you know, getting involved in the local party, which I think is important, right? And going for political office. But how does like this kind of like, you know, movement organizing, grassroots organizing, what role does that have in your vision for, you know, the what you call political revolution led by Gen Z and millennials?
Great question. Yeah. So there's the inside and the outside game. So the inside game is what I play. The inside game is in the party. It's the organizing. It's the stuff I've already talked about. And it is getting people elected to office. The outside game is what you're alluding to, which is like the social pressure, the movement based, and I think they go hand in hand. Of course, I think that there is just this, there's a hyperfixation on performative action in today's society rather than let me just put it this way. The performative action is like, let me post myself on social media, like with a little sign. Great. That's awesome. But the civil rights era didn't change people's minds because they were just standing there with signs. Like they got arrested. They were doing sit-ins. They were breaking the law, genuinely breaking law. Today, while there is some of that, like with certain like climate activists, with certain things, with the current civil rights actions, and broad brush with every other issue, there's good and there's bad organizing, I think. And I think people are influenced by the perception of feeling like they're doing something good. So I do think it takes leaders and it takes movements to be built. Let's just take like the gun control issue, like after Parkland. There's a significant amount of pressure after like the Parkland shooting, and people completely gloss over every shooting now. But like if you remember the Las Vegas shooting that happened right around the same time, like 600 people got shot. Like it's crazy. And the movement then was like, let's go. We got power. It's actually making influence. We have Democrats, Republicans, Independents on board. And then like what happens sometimes with movements is that the gas gets a little let off. It's like, well, we banned bump stocks. It's like, okay, that's what one guy used in one shooting. And I know like it's not to say like, oh, the activism on that side's not working. It is. It's just like broader policy solutions need to be in the mix. And I think that's why it's like all hands on deck. It's inside and outside. It cannot be one or the other. You individually can be one or the other. Like I said, like I'm on the inside, somebody else can be on the outside. It's just figuring out, and the line is hard to find. But like, are you changing people's minds by throwing a milkshake at the Mona Lisa? No. Are you changing people's minds by going outside the Capitol and protesting and doing all this stuff? Maybe. Like there's a line that happens where that works. And I personally don't know where like that movement gets to at some point and says like, okay, now we have it. Because again, like, unfortunately, I think people hijack the movements, which is why institutional power is my focus.
Sure.
But they go hand in hand.
And then, so a few more questions. First is, what do you mean by political revolution? Because when you hear revolution, right, like most people are thinking of like some kind of like massive uprising that often, you know, goes hand in hand with violence in order to kind of remove one regime and replace it with something else, that might be more, you know, small d democratic or people led. But would it explain to listeners like what you mean by political revolution, for Gen Z and millennials?
Definitely. So the first, and I'm just pulling it up while I have it, the first quote, the first line in the book, it says, it's a quote from JFK. It says, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." I use that as the quote because I don't advocate for violence ever, right? Obviously in self-defense, it's a different thing, but revolution can come in different ways. And the way that I see it is we need a radical change in the way that we govern, not just by taking new people in and young people in, but I think that's part of it. But we really need to rethink how government works for the people, not, you know, the Citizens United defined people that include corporations. No, like the people. So a political revolution is a nonviolent action that looks to change the way that government works for all people in this country, not just the select that, and I love the New Deal, not just the select people that happened in the New Deal, you know, in the 50s, everybody. We need to address the issues of poverty and wealth inequality, climate, the lack of healthcare, racial injustice. All these things are like, that's why when I talk about intersectionality, I know there's like the textbook definition, but that's the way that I view it as. All these things together in the form of good governance, not big or small government, but good government. That's the way I view it.
I mean, but how does that work with a Republican Party that has become so radicalized and extremist and so hostile to these kind of values and policies that you just spoke about?
So it depends. Number one, you beat them, which, like, I know that seems simplistic. It sounds silly. But again, this is where pragmatic institutional power works. I mean, if you're a progressive and it's like, well, you know, I don't agree on Joe Biden, like, I support Medicare for all. Joe Biden's never uttered the words, right? But like, if I were to say like, well, I'm not going to vote for him because of that, the alternative is Donald Trump. And we know that when we elect far right people like that, it doesn't develop, oh, we have an even stronger progressive outcome. It's like, no, the party, everybody moves to the right. Everybody moves to the center. So we normalize things because we just want stability. It's not so easy to just be like, well, forget it. We can take multiple approaches to it. And I think you just have to rework how you approach the parties and how you approach elections more broadly, I think, is the key.
And finally, how can people order the book?
You can go to the website, which is Connor-O'Hanlon, which is a very long URL, .presale.manuscripts.com. And on there, there's a multiple different tier levels that you can support. So just so everybody knows, by supporting the campaign, you're helping me get the book into production. You're enabling someone that's a small creator to own my own copyright. So no big company is going to own the copyright of the book. And if you support the presale campaign, you can get your name in the acknowledgments of the book. And at any other tier, you can get a bonus mini ebook, which is the Greater Society platform. So if you, to dig a little bit deeper into the issues that we were talking about today, you know, that's really fleshed out in one of my chapters and it's sold as a mini ebook there. And then you can book me if you wanted to run for office or learn more about it. I'm developing a course that will be coming out in the summer. That's my goal. And you can do one-on-one coaching with me as well through this pre-sale campaign. It helps me get the book into production and also can help you take those leaps and steps into your journey into political organizing and hopefully running for office.
Awesome. We'll make sure to put a link in the show notes. Connor, thanks again for your time and for coming on The Signal. And people, please go ahead, go to the website, order a copy of the book so we can get it into as many hands as possible come this fall when it gets released. Thank you, Connor.
Thank you so much.
This has been The Signal, a podcast by the Bucks County Beacon. I'm Cyril McGlaco, editor-in-chief and host. For more progressive news, analysis, and opinion from Bucks County and beyond, go to www.buckscountybeacon.com.